The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. On the show this week...
People are created equal, but not computers. If everybody was given precisely a computer of the same power and was issued a computer programmer of the same cleverness, then it would work.
Computer scientist, musician, and internet guru Jaron Lanier unpacks the social ramifications of the open web when he discusses his provocative new book, Who Owns the Future? And...
He's not a theologian, he's not even a scholar, and he claims that his computational skills are sufficient to override any text, scriptural or otherwise, by his calculations.
Alok Jha discovers the little-known side of Newton as radical revisionist historian when he meets the authors of Newton and the Origin of Civilization, Jed Buchwald and Mordecai Feingold. Observer science editor Robin McKee joins me to discuss this week's science news, including a growing consensus on the Higgs, evidence of H2O on HR8799C, and the bicentenary of the father of epidemiology, John Snow. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Jaron Lanier is a computer scientist whose research played a key role in the development of virtual reality. A precocious talent, his work has informed the development of Microsoft's Kinect, Linden Lab's Second Life, and most recently, Google's Glass. He's also a highly regarded musician and a popular science writer with some provocative and controversial views on the global dominance of the World Wide Web. His 2010 book, You Are Not a Gadget, was a searing manifesto against mass mediocrity and warned how the internet stifled creativity. His latest book continues in this vein. It is titled Who Owns the Future? And along with my Tech Weekly colleague, Jemima Kish, I quizzed Jaron about the central argument of his new book.
I'm proposing in this book that there was a flaw that I was part of conceiving some decades ago in the idea of open culture and making computer systems open. And the flaw is very simply that if there's an open network where everybody's sharing, whoever has the biggest computer on that network is automatically, whether they want it or not, put in the position of being the spy master on everyone else because they can calculate the world to their advantage. And that inequality becomes unsustainable. This is exactly what ruined finance recently and has forced austerity on the developed world. And I think it's also what has brought a gradual lessening of horizons for people in the creative pursuits like journalism and music. And it's not sustainable. It's something we need to shift. And I think we can come up with equally idealistic and much better and much more effective ways to design a network that are actually more fair than our first pass.
So the whole idea of information being free is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, because people are created equal, but not computers. And so, you know, if everybody was given precisely a computer of the same power and was issued a computer programmer of the same cleverness, then it would work. But that's not possible in the real world.
So if we talk about concentration of power, whether it's governments or institutions or corporations who are controlling the kind of the short tail of computer power, if you like. How are we ever gonna break that cycle? How can the longer tail of people who need kind of access to the computational power of these networks, how are they gonna break through?
Right. Well, okay, so the current way things work is that we've all learned to expect treats from the modern age. And the problem is that we always pay for them in the long term. So an example of a treat is a really easy mortgage on your property. But then the reason that thing came into existence is that there was somebody with a big computer on a network calculating away a perfect scheme that would force risk on everyone else. And at the end of the day, everyone has to take on reduced credit and austerity and pain in order to cover the costs of these initial treats. And I feel that pattern is repeated again and again in this age of power accruing to whoever has the biggest computer. And so there is an alternative, which I think is better, and that is to make information cost money. And of course, this is exactly the sort of most poisonous thing one can say in many circles now. Because we have whole political parties, the pirate parties, who are founded on exactly the contrary idea. And believe me, I've had tremendous sympathy for that notion. I helped articulate it in the first place many years ago. However, making information paid has enormous advantages that I think will persuade people eventually. here's an example of an advantage. Right now, because the idea is that information is free and it's accumulated by whoever has the biggest computer, we've learned to just acquiesce to being spied upon constantly and to have dossiers about ourselves created in various bunkers that belong to the people with the big computers. And we might have different degrees of sympathy according to what we call that bunker, you know, if whether it's a national intelligence agency or a California company like Facebook or Google or a big banking or finance scheme. But in all cases, it's really the same thing. Now, if information were paid, we would earn some money when someone else is able to use our information. And furthermore, we'd be able to set our own price, thus determining to what degree they're able to use our information. And they would only make money to the degree they could actually do something useful that they could charge for with it. They wouldn't make money simply from being able to have the biggest computer and the largest accumulation.
This overlaps really nicely with something that the investor Esther Dyson was talking about recently, which is her her idea that you should pay to send email, which from a sender's point of view you think, no, that would be outrageous. But from a recipient's point of view, thinking about your inbox and the marketing you receive is quite radical. Do you see an overlap there?
Well, sure. And Esther's taken a lot of heat over the years for proposing this, and I think she's quite right, though, because otherwise there's no end to spam. But I think the idea might be more complete at the point where there's reciprocity. So what I mean by that is right now, I'm not willing to go wag my finger at somebody who's using torrent streams or something like that, doing copies, for the simple reason that there's no reciprocity. I want to see that person earning money from the same system to go to tell people, well, you're only allowed to spend money on the system, but you're not allowed to earn from it, is preposterous. We have to have a social contract that people really believe in order to have a society. And money valuable has to be done in the service of everybody. It has to be done in the service of ordinary people. We're so used to being these sheep who are just sort of consumers at the end of this thing. It's like, it's so strange. Like, people can't even conceive of themselves as full citizens. So, you know, it's a very strange thing to me. It's like people have fallen so low now that their idea of the best possible outcome is that things are free, but they don't even think about earning. But we have to start thinking about earning. And the reason why is that automation is coming. I mean, like, the idea lately has been, well, it's okay for information to be free because there'll be other stuff that's paid, in the case of musicians, it's live appearances or something like that. And what's so funny is that was originally my argument. I think I made that one up 30 years ago. But anyway, it doesn't matter who did. But the problem, well, there's two problems with it. One problem is that for real people, like, if you're 20, you can run around and sing for your supper for every meal. If you're 50, it gets harder. And if you're 70, it's impossible, you know. And it's just too hard for real people in real life to live that way. It's living in an informal economy instead of in a formal economy. It's what people in developing countries are trying to get out of. And we're suddenly thrusting ourselves in the other direction back into it. So that's one problem. But the even bigger problem is that in the coming decades, the vehicles will start to drive themselves, and product manufacture will happen in 3D printers and other devices that require much, much less human labor. And the information is all that will be left, you know. The information economy has to be monetized, or else better technology just means a contracting economy that concentrates power in ever fewer people. And so, you know, what's funny is the origin of the open idea was very leftist. The idea was that, oh, money's a bad thing. And I remember neo-Marxists or just outright Marxists talking about using computation to starve the beast of capitalism eventually. And that term, starve the beast, is now used in America by people who want to kill government instead by by bankrupting it. But at any rate, the problem with that is that what it would in fact do, and what we didn't realize at the time, is concentrate power and wealth, you know, arbitrarily, infinitely, with whoever has the biggest computer. And that's just not sustainable. It's just not, it's not working. And we can already see it not working now. So we have a few decades to reverse course before automation really becomes big, or else we'll have some sort of chaos. We might have a sudden socialist backlash, which could be ugly, or we'll just all acquiesce to some sort of science fiction scenario of being, automatons in somebody's grand computation scheme.
How do you chart that course towards monetizing information? I mean, or do you think that things, is there a way of doing it fairly painlessly, or do you think the situation is going to get so would get so bad that everybody starts realizing what you're, you know, the kind of issues you're talking about, and then you get a fight back.
Well, to get from here to there is, of course, the very hardest thing to think about. And in the new book, I outline a number of scenarios for how we might get from here to there. And I think, you know, roughly speaking, there's fast ways and there's slow ways. And I want to advocate a slow way. The fast way is to come up with some sort of scheme that people suddenly buy into that rises very quickly in the way that these network schemes do. So, you know, some sort of giant mega Kickstarter sort of thing that changes society and suddenly we're in this different economy. And many people are enthused for, you know, with the notion of designing that sudden transformation. And maybe it's possible. But what I'm advocating personally is a much more gradual back and forth empirical sort of process, because I think we have a couple of decades to fix this, that would bounce back and forth between arguing with the companies and having political dialogue and trying experiments and so forth. Because I think what would come out of that is a more adult and balanced outcome. I think this sort of desire for instant gratification is part of the issue and is part of what's gone wrong. And what we need to do is be more empirical. The thing that really bugs me about digital idealism, the pirate parties and everything, is that, you know, it's utopian. It's not looking at actual results, you know. And if somebody isn't being helped, it's their own fault. You know, we're not, and I'm not willing to descend to that kind of cruel way of thinking. And that's what I've seen happen in my community. And I just can't accept it.
A lot of the ideas that you're talking about around monetization seem to assume that the value is monetary, when actually isn't the exchange often it's money for something people value. So on the Guardian news site, to use an example close to home, people aren't paying, but they are getting in value information and news that's really valuable to them. So they're not giving us any money. What's missing in that sort of exchange?
No, listen, I'm not saying that there's no value exchange in this sort of free economy. The problem with it is it creates an informal economy. It creates exactly what the third world is trying to climb its way out of. It creates a kind of value exchange that doesn't lead to sustenance or momentum in individual lives. It doesn't help people make it through periods when they're sick. It doesn't account for the realities of the human life cycle. It's a moment-to-moment kind of value that's forgotten in an instant. It doesn't lead to dignity. And that's a subtle concept, and it's especially hard perhaps for young people to get it, but it's the essence of civilization. And if we can't get over that hump, we're not really serving people.
Given that you were instrumental in setting up the technology behind Google Glass, do you find there's some contradiction there between helping develop that technology and then handing it over to an organization that's so all-powerful?
Well, let's be clear. I haven't had anything to do with the development of Google Glass specifically, although many of my colleagues and people from a startup of mine that Google bought and blah, 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 you know, I have many connections to it, but the specific thing is not my development at all. And I wish them well. They're friends, you know, and I want them to do well. But there is this sort of creepy aspect to it, which is that because of this economic model, in order to use it, you have to sort of acquiesce to Google's computers compiling this very intimate diary of your life, having better memories of your life than you would, if you like, and then having to make some commercial use of that, which in the short, you know, and once again, getting to this question of value exchange, I'm sure there'll be value to you, especially in the short term. It might help you find your way better or whatever it is. But the thing is, in the long term, the only way Google can make money is by serving the interests of third parties who you can't know about ever, really, and certainly not in advance, who will get information about you and influence what options are right in front of you. And that will, on a statistical basis, maybe not you individually, but overall, that'll influence how people vote and who they date and who gets credit. It'll guide society from a central planning bureau, you know, in a very creepy way. And it really bugs me. But even on top of that, it's not even in Google's interest. And that's, you know, so I've been talking about it sort of from a left perspective of it, because most people from the left have supported this open ideal, even though I think they're wrong to do so. But even from Google's perspective, it ultimately is ruining their own market because it forces a contraction of the economy. You know, just as when financiers wanted to radiate risk out by calculating the perfect schemes for themselves and then just destroyed the economy within which they make any sense in the first place, Google's going to do that to the overall economy in which it makes any sense. I mean, they're actually undoing themselves in the long term. And that's why I think they'll eventually stop and move to a different... I think they will will come to realize it, because I think it's the mathematical truth.
So there may actually be a reason for the Siren servers to change tack as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an analogy I might draw is Henry Ford designed the early cars to be affordable by his own factory workers so that an economy could grow. Because the idea is, as the economy grows, then capitalists can do better than just concentrating wealth. You know, that's the trick of capitalism. And so that's why middle classes are good even for the most successful entrepreneurs, because gilding can't just float on a vacuum. You need to have the gilding needs to gild something. So even if you want to be the super elite capitalist, you need to have some sort of wealthy bourgeoisie to buy your stuff or something. So at the very least, it doesn't turn into a total concentration of wealth. So that's sort of the silver lining of capitalism. And right now we're not even at that point in the digital age. I think we could do much better than that, but we're not even there. And so I sort of think sometimes called Google and Ouroboros, which is a snake eating its own tail, where right now, you know, the idea is you demonetize things in order to advertise other things, but then gradually those things are being demonetized too. So you demonetize journalism and music to turn them into spying operations to gather their bait, to gather data about people.
Google make of this, though?
They listen. You know, I give me 10 years. I'll convince them. No, they're very sweet. You know, the thing is, there aren't villains here. I don't believe in this idea that they're like bad people and good people. I think the folks here are mostly pretty good. In the finance world, maybe not so much, but,
impression of Google is that they're extremely clever, but they don't always think, you know, whether just because they can do something doesn't mean they should. And so the ramifications of the technology that they create and deploy, even they don't really understand.
Well, there's a tremendous power rush of you know, having the biggest computer, because you can calculate the world to your liking and influence it, you know. So it's very seductive when you're in that position.
A huge thanks to Jaron Lanier there. Who Owns the Future is published by Alan Lane and in all good bookshops on and offline now. You can also learn about Jaron on his own website, jaronlanier.com. Now it's time to look at some of this week's other science news stories, and I'm joined by the Observer science editor, Robin McKee. Welcome to the podcast, Robin.
My pleasure.
Let's kick off with a story I wrote up this week about an interesting planet called HR8799C. And the interesting thing about that was it was work by a North American team who had done the most precise atmospheric measurements ever of a planet outside our solar system. And what's nice about this planet is it's so large. It's about seven times the mass of our own Jupiter, and our own solar system is basically Jupiter plus the sun. This planet is so large and far away from its own star that you can see it directly with telescopes. So whereas a lot of these exoplanets, their presence is just inferred by the kind of wobble they produce on the star or some other effects, this planet can be imaged directly. And what the team did was they used this, one of the big telescopes at the Keck Observatory on Hawaii, and an instrument that can, for every pixel of light it picks up on its detectors, it gives you a spectrum. And so you can look at the wavelengths of infrared light coming directly from that planet. So what they did with that is look at all of the light coming through and pick it apart to see what gases must be in the atmosphere of the planet, because the gases absorb the infrared light to different extents. And what they show is that this planet has an atmosphere that's rich in water vapor, rich in carbon dioxide, and interestingly enough, had no methane. I mean, you'd find a lot of methane, obviously, on this planet, in this planet's atmosphere, because a lot of living organisms produce it. But it's the most precise measurements ever done on the atmosphere of a planet. And that was nice, because it doesn't tell you anything about whether this planet is habitable. I mean, you already know this planet wouldn't be habitable. It's far too hot. It hasn't even got a solid surface. I don't think it's going to support life as we know it. But it does allow them to say, well, we know from the ratio of the water and the oxygen and the carbon in the atmosphere how this planet formed. And it's likely that it formed by this process called core accretion, where you just get small, in this case, tiny ice particles that will be forming and clustering together out of this disk of material around the early star. And it gradually accumulates and accumulates and accumulates to the point where it actually starts gravitationally bringing in other matter until it forms this absolutely ginormous planet.
The interesting thing about this, it does suggest that the idea of core accretion is one of the main theories for the formation of planets. It does suggest from several different kind of aspects of the study that this is the way that planets formed. And interestingly enough, one of the things that core accretion predicts is that you will have solar systems that have big gas giants at their outer edges and small rocky planets, which are more likely to be homes of living forms, on their closer to the sun. Now, that's what we see in this solar system, but until now, that's the only example we have, so we never know whether that's just chance or it actually shows core accretion. Now, from what we can see from this study, core accretion looks right. It therefore explains the makeup of our solar system and suggests that other solar systems will be similar. As to the kind of lack of methane, well, as far as I can see, this planet's quite young, and it would not have had much time anyway to produce living things, which, you know, turn carbon monoxide and dioxide and water vapor into methane amongst many things. So we wouldn't really expect it to have life, and we wouldn't expect it to produce methane. But it's a fabulous piece of science, and just shows you the extent to which astrobiology is beginning to run away with itself as a science, and how we'll be able to study different planets with unimaginable precision.
That's right. I mean, this planet is, in planetary terms, very young. It's only 30 million years old, and it's so young, it's really hot as a result. And that's another reason why this one was a really good planet to go for, because it's huge and very bright in the infrared. This star system has at least four big planets, and they talk about it as being a very sort of large-scale version of our own solar system, but the comparison is fairly weak. They have four planets that they know of. The chances are that there may, as Robin was saying, be some smaller ones as you get closer to the star, and perhaps some small rocky ones. Now, the technological problem then becomes is, how do you look at the atmospheres of those planets? Because you would then hope to, if you could do it, you would, you know, hope to be able to see chemical signatures in those atmospheres that tell you that there is something alive there, if it's there. But the smaller you get, and, you know, bear in mind that Earth will be far smaller than Jupiter, the smaller you get away from these huge gas giants, the much fainter the light that comes from them, but also they're closer to their star. Mm. So the sun from the star is swamping it out as well. So technologically, you're up against a really tough problem, and you have to be thinking about dedicated space-based telescopes with a technology that we don't really have at the moment to even think of doing. I mean, I think we're looking at decades before we can do that.
Yes. On the other hand, nobody could have dreamed 20 years ago we were doing what we are doing now. So, kind of, you know, it's hopeful, put it that way.
Robin, you were looking at John Snow, the anniversary of his birth, I believe.
Yes, he was born 200 years ago on March 15th, last Friday. A great man, the father of epidemiology, probably best known for the work he did on the cholera outbreaks that they had in London in the 1830s, 40s and 50s. And it was his pioneering use of good statistics and data that helped unpick what was essentially the cause of cholera, which was contaminated water, drinking water contaminated by sewage. At the time, most people argued that cholera was a disease caused by a miasma, something in the air, something you breathed in. And he said, no, it is not. It is polluted water. In those days, sewage and water supplies were privatized. It was desperately inadequate, we would say, to put it mildly. And he eventually managed to pin down a cholera outbreak which killed 600 people. We forget that. 1854 killed in London, 600 people died from cholera. And he showed that people who used a particular water pump for their water, few people had water in their houses, this water must be contaminated. It was interesting because he was able to show a house in Hampstead that was affected by the cholera. Now, why was that? It's because the woman of the house liked the water from this pump and sent her maid down to Broad Street, which is now Broadick Street, which is in Soho, sent her maid down for her water there, and in the process gave the whole household cholera. Two blocks away, there was a brewery, and not a single worker was affected by cholera. Why not? They got free beer. They didn't need to drink water, so they were unaffected. So by piecing an incredibly detailed piecing together of data showing who was affected, who tracing down who's a pump. He managed to show that this pump was the source of cholera. He had the handle taken off, although by that point, the outbreak was fading. And in a sense, he didn't manage to save lives, but in the process, of course, he founded a science that indisputably has saved probably millions, hundreds of millions of lives. A great man, a really great man.
Talking of breweries, I used to work at New Scientist, which at the time was on Wardour Street, just around the corner from what is now Broadwick Street, and where they now have the pump. And near that, there's a pub called the John Snow. Was he a bit of a boozer?
He said, a good question. He certainly was not. He was a vociferous teetotaler. He would have been revolving in his grave now if he knew a pub was named after him. But if you go into that pub and you go upstairs, they've got various, around the wall, they've got various kind of paintings and little exhibits detailed to John Snow. In the end, he turned from epidemiology into study the first anaesthetics. And he founded a proper science of showing how these first anaesthetics should be used on dosages and things like that. And later, towards the end of his life, he died quite young though, but he was the man who gave Queen Victoria anaesthetics for the birth of, I think, her last two children. So, I mean, again, he was a really great scientist. I think it's good to honour a great man like that 200 years after he was born.
We actually have an interactive of his cholera map on the Guardian Science site, where they've sort of geotagged all of the cases retrospectively. Yeah. And you can see where the size of the number of deaths essentially at different parts and where the pump is from this. And you can see where, as you were saying, you get high numbers of deaths suspiciously far from the pump, but then where the brewery is, an absolute lack of deaths because they're all drinking, they had their own water supply, I think, and they were drinking beer for the rest of the day.
I think it just proves that beer is, you know, proof that God loves us and wants to be happy, as Benjamin Franklin's in.
Finally, the Higgs boson was in the news again last week, and that was because the scientists at CERN had been to a conference in Italy to give their latest data. And this was about two and a half times as much data as they had from July, when they announced the tentative discovery of the Higgs boson. What it adds this time round, well, when they made the discovery, they were calling it a Higgs-like particle because it looked for all the world like a Higgs, and the search had been directed towards that, but they didn't know enough to be sure. The scientists are now saying that you can probably ditch that Higgs-like and call it a Higgs boson now. All of the results are showing that it behaves as expected for the kind of simplest kind of Higgs boson. And what does that mean? It means that it, as soon as it's created, this particle disintegrates. It's so unstable, but it disintegrates into the normal particles in the right kind of proportions, the right numbers of times. So it's, for all the world, looking like the Higgs boson that was predicted by Peter Higgs back in 64. It's a little bit too early to be absolutely sure. It may be that this still ends up being one of many different types of Higgs particle. There may be others to be found, but working out if there are any subtle quirks in this particle's behavior is going to take an awfully long time. And bear in mind now that the Large Hadron Collider has been switched off, it's now off until 2015, while a lot of work is done to make it ready to run at full energy in that year. So I don't suspect we'll be hearing a lot more about the properties of the Higgs for some time now. That's the news for this week. Thanks to Robin McKee there. To read all of Robin's writing on science, pick up a copy of The Observer on Sunday or go to guardian.co.uk/science.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition. The election of a new pope is God's Olympics. Global publicity, weeping crowds, and no meaning. Harlem Shake, an online phenomenon. Could it kill sampling? And we look back at the career of Minette Walters, whose first crime novel, The Ice Room, was published in 1992, and catch up with the latest from Fred Vargas, the ghostwriters of Audebeck. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/guardian or find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Audioboo. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Isaac Newton is a towering figure in science, but a little-known aspect of his legacy is that of a historian. Newton's Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended, published in 1728, 1 year after his death, unleashed a storm of controversy. The book presented a drastically revised timeline for ancient civilizations, contracting Greek history by 500 years and Egypt's by a millennium. This is the topic of Newton and the Origin of Civilization by the historians Jed Buchwald and Mordecai Feingold. Their book tells the story of how one of the most celebrated figures in the history of mathematics, optics, and mechanics came to apply his unique ways of thinking to problems of history. For Science Weekly, Alok Jha met up with Jed and Mordecai and started out by asking them how big a part of Newton's life was his work as a historian.
Well, it was actually quite big. I mean, he spent a considerable amount of time doing what we would call historical studies. And as I said, over more than four decades doing that, he left behind hundreds of thousands of words devoted to historical studies. And as we investigated it, we realized that he applied the same criteria of rigor and evidence to the historical studies as he did to alchemical and mechanical or optical. So he was rigorous and serious in everything he did. And it's just, that's one of the things that we found quite amazing, how consistent he was in his determination to pursue evidence wherever it led, albeit with a certain agenda in mind.
Now, Jed, Newton was a great astronomer, amongst many other things as well, as we've discussed. How did he use that to construct this chronology?
Well, strictly speaking, he's not an astronomer. That is, when he was young, he did do some observations, but nothing beyond that. He's a calculator. Usually when you think about Newton, you think about mathematics, you think about the calculus, you think about light. You know, he had a particle theory of light. He discovered that white light is made up out of colors and so on. But you put yourself back in the 17th century, you have to imagine that this is a period of time in which the very idea of what you do in an experiment and how you handle measurements is new. Not many people are doing it. And when he was very young at Cambridge, he developed novel ways of handling measurements. So, for example, if I were to take a ruler and put it on a piece of paper and ask you to measure the length of a line, and I ask you to do it 10 times, you're going to get 10 different numbers. So what do we do with those numbers today? Well, scientists today, since the last part of the 18th century, use statistics to figure out what the best result would be.
You'd average them out.
You'd average it. In the 17th century, you don't do that, because if you were to print a paper with 10 different numbers on it, they would have thought you were incompetent. You had to write down the best number that you could get. But Newton, very early on, is the first one who doesn't operate like that. His skepticism of what the human senses are capable of producing was so profound that he decided early on to put together all of these bad numbers, each one of which was inherently terrible, and out of those to sort of forge a new number. And that way of working passed over into the chronology, and it did so in the following way. So how are you going to redate the past? Well, you have data from the past, but the data is words. The words come down from a commentary written by an ancient astronomer, a famous one named Hipparchus. Many people have heard of Hipparchus. It's the only thing we have from him. He wrote a commentary on a poem that was written for Greek and Roman gentlemen. Talked about the heavens, where the constellations are. And it says things like, a certain feature of the heavens passed through a certain constellation. Now, what Newton did was, he would take that and try to transform it into a number. And to do that, you had to make decisions about what stars were involved and so on, and then apply pretty extensive computational techniques. And so what he did out of that was he had 10 numbers in two sets of five each. And what particularly interesting about that, without going into any detail, is one set of numbers was inherently more accurate than the other set. So keeping the data completely separate. He put the two separately together and forged a single result out of that. And the result of that was to redate the Trojan War by hundreds of years, pushing it forward to to post 930 BCE. And that was a gigantically controversial result.
I mean, that puts lots of civilizations in contact, out of contact, all sorts of things there. I mean, how was that work received? How was something like that? It's quite a major change to the historical record. How was it received by his contemporaries at the time?
Well, the chronology turned out to be his most controversial work in the 18th century, even more than the Principia, partly, of course, because it was written without numbers. I mean, Newton left most of the calculation in manuscripts, but it was also much more accessible than the very, very difficult Principia, but partly because it mattered more than the Principia. I mean, chronology was inherently a subject matter associated with theology, and everybody cared about ancient history. Newton, like anybody else at the time, believed that the scripture is the most reliable ancient history that you could get. So if you redate the past, cutting 500 years from Greek history, 1,200 years from Egyptian history, and you seem to contradict in certain aspects scripture, for example, if Newton argues that letters and astronomy was invented only around Solomon's time, what do you do with a biblical scripture telling you that Moses, 500 years earlier, were in possession of all the knowledge of the Egyptians? So some aspects of Newton's chronology did not only change pagan history, but it had immediate relevance for theology. So in England, quite a few people, of course, were quite happy with the theology, with the chronology, but many objected for various reasons. There are two reasons in particular. The first is that given his prominence, the very fact that the great Newton is publishing a chronology immediately make people believe it. Second, in England, because Newton was Englishman, it was the pride of the English and many accepted it, not all, of course. But what bothered people in England, and as we will hear in a moment on the continent as well, is that here comes a mathematician, and he claims that for authority in a subject matter that is not his. He is not a theologian, he is not even a scholar. And he claims that his computational skills are sufficient to override any text, scriptural or otherwise, by his calculations. And that, of course, was very problematic.
The facts of his timeline clearly haven't been proven to be incorrect, but are any of his ideas and methods still relevant to the way people construct these sorts of chronologies today? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems from everything you said, incredibly difficult, and there's no reason why Virgil should have written accurate historical information in his poem, because he was writing a story about a particular time which doesn't need a time, and the point of any fictional narrative is that you can change histories around to fit the story. So in a sense, Newton and others would have been trying to apply something which was never intended on those texts. But is that method in any way valid in today?
Well, so that's a good question. A few years ago, an archaeologist at Cornell University, I think it was about 6 years ago, attempted on the basis of numerical measurements, I forget of exactly what, there were measurements of spreads of agriculture and so on, to redate the time at which the Minoan civilization on Santorini would have interacted with the New Kingdom dynasty in Egypt, pushed it around by about 150 years. It was based on numerical data, right? The Egyptologists reacted immediately. This is recent, saying, no, this is completely inconsistent with our textual data and other materials that we have at the same time. So there you have a kind of conflict today that's not dissimilar to the one you had from the past. I think the issue, in a certain sense, is this. Can you as it were, incinerate all of human history in a kind of numerical furnace or not? I mean, do you throw out the records of the past and so on and replace them entirely with what, in retrospect, can often be quite speculative but hard-looking numerical data?
Are the numbers king, basically?
Are the numbers king, or are they not? Now, I mean, I was trained as a physicist originally to think that, in fact, numbers are king. Of course, you see, Newton looked at all of that stuff, and to the extent that he thought there was anything in it, he tried to map it to real people and real times. In other words, take the myth out of mythology. You can't take the myth out of mythology. You remove the human element from it. And that, I think, is not what's wrong, but that's the thrust of what he was trying to do. And it's the thrust that I think remains today.
Jed, Mordecai, thank you both very much indeed.
Newton and the Origin of Civilization is published by Princeton and available in all good bookshops. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.